Good afternoon. Welcome to this forest event. Should smoking be consigned to history? Answer, no. You can all go home. But that's only my opinion. And of course, I am in a minority. I'm Claire Fox. I'm the director of the Academy of Ideas. And it's an interesting... Well, I'm delighted that so many of you are here and not watching Boris. I'm delighted, or you couldn't get in, or you've left him, or whatever. But in all seriousness, I understand that an issue like smoking at a conference like this can appear to be something of a fringe issue, particularly in the post-Brexit frenzy and a world that presents us with many challenges. And, you know, somebody said to me when I said that I was doing this, they said, oh, well, you know, it's a bit of a kind of niche issue, surely. But actually, I think, and I know that this is sort of a sentiment that Simon shares, that actually one of the issues, an issue like smoking is one of the key freedom issues, I think, in society. And although people sort of see it as, why are they talking about lifestyles and all the rest of it, these issues that we know resonate with people in society, like taking back control and about having freedom and choice, are much bigger issues than whether you smoke or not. And smoking is just an illustration, and the attitude to smoking and to lifestyle choices, I think, is just an illustration of a changing atmosphere in terms of how we think of a free society today. So I'm delighted to be here for that reason, because it's not that I'm not here because I smoke, as people will sometimes assume, but because I actually support freedom. And I'm concerned that issues like smoking are used to batter freedom over the head. But this is actually an unusual kind of event, because over recent years, the people who have led the assault on smoking have been none other than tobacco companies, which is an unusual turn of events, to say the least. So when Philip Morris International declared that it would work towards a smoke-free world, and that they wanted everyone to stop smoking or switch to a less harmful product, I think those of us who'd been kind of interested in this issue of lifestyle choice and freedom were bemused, to say the least. And I think it's a really good idea for us to try and get to the bottom of that and to think about what it means. Philip Morris International have really taken the lead on this, and their company is going to contribute £1 billion to a new organisation, the Foundation for a Smoke-Free World. And so what we're going to talk about today is that the aspiration? You know, it's all very well saying that old fogies like me, who've been smoking a long time, just can't get used to this new world. Should that be the kind of world we want to live in? That's really the question on the table. And we've actually got a number of people who are going to approach this, I think, from different directions. And then we're just going to have a sort of general open conversation about it. So first of all, let me introduce my speakers. There's Simon Clark, who's our host. He's the director of Forest, the organisation which stands for Freedom, the Freedom Organisation for the Right to Enjoy Smoking Tobacco. And that word enjoy is an unusual one today as well, because if you do smoke, you're at least meant to suffer and not enjoy it. So I thought it was worth resurrecting that word. Simon has run a number of campaigns in relation to Forest, Hands Off Our Packs in terms of plain packaging, and No Thanks, No Thank You EU campaign, opposing restrictive new regulations imposed on us by the EU's revised tobacco products directive. And I think it's actually rather brave of Forest to organise this event, because maybe it should be, you know, should Forest be consigned to history? Because in some ways, if smoking is consigned to history, there'll be no reason for Forest. But I think it's a really important discussion. Then we've then got Chris Snowden. Many of you will have be familiar with him, of course. He's the head of lifestyle economics at the IEA. He does an invaluable job in terms of taking on these arguments in the public sphere, in on the media. His research focuses on lifestyle freedom and prohibition and policy-based evidence. And he's brilliant at debunking some of the misuse of evidence in relation to all manner of assaults on choice and freedom. He's a regular contributor to Spectator Health, to CapEx, to Spiked, and he's the editor of the Nanny State Index and the author of 5 books, Killjoys being one of my favourites, and very much in line with today's theme. We then have Ray Mile, who is sitting next to me, who's got 30 years experience in the city, initially as a fund manager, and since 1998, a stockbroker with Casanova, JP Morgan and Senko's. And he's been following the tobacco sector since the early 1990s. And I think it's important to have somebody who, from a business perspective and as an outsider looking in, can talk about what the issues are in relation to the tobacco companies changing their position, what it all means in terms of the tobacco wars. And he's interested, of course, in the delivery of substantial returns to shareholders. So that's another aspect of the kind of corporate responsibility that's sometimes ignored. And then last but not least is Mark McGregor. Mark is Corporate Affairs Director at Philip Morris. He's been involved in politics for over 30 years, has fought several parliamentary elections for the Conservative Party, was the Chief Executive of the Conservative Central Office 2002-2003, ran Steve Norris's campaign to be Mayor of London, and was Deputy Director of Policy Exchange, and of course now is at Philip Morris. So I want to start with Mark, just to kind of kick things off, because Mark is quoted as saying, "Our business is committed to going smoke-free as fast as possible and ultimately stopping selling cigarettes altogether," which is odd. So, Mark, based on the fact that you're not secretly Public Health England, sneaked in, seriously, this is a big play by Philip Morris to lead the world on this question. Yeah. Give us a clue as to what's going on.
Yeah, look, well, firstly, thank you for the invitation. Thank you for that introduction. I'd sort of forgotten about some of those roles I'd held in the past, but thank you for reminding me of them. Look, I think in part it's just a recognition of reality. Philip Morris is the world's biggest cigarette company, but it's a company that is very good at planning for the longer term. That's why it's been so hugely successful. And you only have to look at the trends in most Western countries, about most parts of the world, not all, but most parts of the world, where smoking rates are falling. And so in a sense, it may be good for society that if all smoking ends, but actually it's also incredibly good for our business if we develop alternatives and manage to become the biggest player, let's be honest, that's our ambition, in the new world. So whether it's e-cigarettes, heated tobacco, or other innovative products I think are likely to come down the line. So look, it's a sensible business decision, but also, you know, I'm relatively new to the company and to this area. It feels to me a little bit like, you know, technology has finally arrived, and 150 years since Philip Morris has set up, technology has finally arrived in the tobacco sector. You know, the product that, there's actually a guy called Philip Morris that set up his first shop in London, the product that he sold back then is pretty much the same as is available now. But actually, the development of e-cigarettes and other innovative products that are coming online now, they feel as if they are a way of allowing smokers to have access to products that provide them with nicotine, but without the harm. And therefore, look, we've spent something like £3 billion in developing those products. We're going to spend a lot more going forward. So I think it feels like it's a natural step for us to take as a big company. It doesn't mean that we're in favour of people being banned from smoking. If you want to smoke, it's completely up to them. But it feels like, for our business at least, it feels like that's the sensible way to go. And you mentioned it is our ambition in, you know, to get there as fast as possible. Yeah, but that's just a sensible business strategy from our point of view.
So just to explain, in case people don't know, so the IQOS product is the one that you're particularly pushing. So you're developing new products. It's not as though you're saying everyone stop smoking and we'll go out of business. You're developing replacements for smoking as we know it. Is that effective?
Yeah, I think it would be a very odd business if they simply say, hey, look, you guys all just stop smoking, that's our business. I don't throw our shareholders, I'd be interested in their comments later. Hey, look, we'll sort of shut up shop. It's not that. We believe we have a role to play in helping to convert smokers to one of our alternative products. And you say, obviously, you mentioned IQOS. Well, we actually have a range of e-cigarettes. We just launched a new product called IQOS Mesh, which is our first own brand cigarette that we've developed. We actually bought another e-cigarette company a few years ago, but we just launched that. And we have other platforms that are on the way. But yeah, look, heated tobacco is the first heated tobacco product that's been launched by any company. BAT have one, JTI have one, Imperial claim to have one. So, you know, we think it's the direction of travel for all the companies. I guess the difference is that we've taken that, as you say, we've taken the bolder step. So we've said, look, actually, we can envisage a time in the not too distant future where we just stop selling cigarettes. And in my mind, that almost certainly is going to start in those countries where smoking prevalence is the lowest.
Okay, so just the final question before I turn around to Simon. But, you know, I was reading an interview with, I think it's the person who runs your London office that has got 400 employees.
Yes, Peter, yeah.
Who says, there's only one who smokes left and I'm still working on him. So when you say that you're not trying to ban people, it does have a kind of zealotry about it. I mean, leave that guy alone a bit. But also kind of 400 employee boasting none of them smoke. I mean, that seems to be more than just having a long-term, rather pragmatic approach. That's a kind of that's the anti-smoking atmosphere we're all used to if we're smoking.
I guess if you work for Apple and someone said, hey, look, I like the Apple product, but I've decided I'm gonna use a Samsung phone around the office, you might come in for some internal criticism. And I guess for us, we want to ensure that as many of our employees convert to one of our products. It's probably never going to be everybody. But we believe that our product, or our products, a range of products, offer people a way to stop smoking, and therefore it feels like we should share the information with them, we have kind of coaches who actually help people stop smoking.
Public Health England, I'm telling you.
But the one thing that, I mean, and I'm sure we'll come into this later, one of the things that, two things. One, my observation coming to this area is that the government doesn't actually seem to much care about smoking anymore. There are plenty of other public health issues that have risen up the agenda of obesity and mental health, and I actually still think it's an incredibly important issue, and particularly where there are no alternatives. And the second is that, you know, the biggest problem is that half of smokers don't realise that or e-cigarettes and the like are less harmful. So my job at Philip Morris is at least to explain to your smokers, look, this product, if you want to carry on smoking, do. But at least you should be aware that if you do stop using it and switch to an e-cigarette or tobacco, you are making a better decision for your health.
Okay, so that sounds like a totally pragmatic case. Perfectly reasonably put, Simon, what's your problem with it? It's not anti-nicotine, is it?
No, not at all. And let me start by saying that we support 100% the whole campaign towards risk reduction products. I mean, you'd be mad not to, because the fact is it's very clear from current evidence that e-cigarettes and even heat-not-burn products appear to be far less risky for people's health. Plus also, Forest has always supported choice and personal responsibility. So if consumers choose to switch or choose to quit, that's entirely a matter for them. And I have to say, on the subject of IQOS, for example, I don't use IQOS because I'm not a smoker, but I'm a huge fan of IQOS. I was first alerted to IQOS about 3 years ago. I met somebody in Switzerland who used it. He was a former smoker, and he raved about it. He said it's fantastic because he said, look, for him, he didn't get on with e-cigarettes, but he found that IQOS was perfect for him because it was still a tobacco product. It was much more like smoking a cigarette, but obviously it had far less health risks associated with it. So as soon as I heard that, I started going out and doing a bit of research, and I began to meet other consumers who've also switched to IQOS as well as vaping. And clearly there are a lot of people out there who love vaping, and some people, a smaller number, who love heat-not-burn products. So we embrace all these products in the name of choice. But choice is the absolutely vital factor here. And what I sort of get the feeling is, with the likes of Public Health England, and to a certain extent PMI, is that, yes, we're going to put choice out there, let people choose, as long as they choose to switch. But if they decide, no, they actually enjoy smoking and don't want to switch, then we're going to sort of hammer them until they do. And I think that's totally wrong, because tobacco is still a legal product. And if people do choose to go on smoking, that's a matter for them. And one of the big issues that's almost become taboo these days to talk about is the fact there are still millions of people who get a great deal of pleasure from smoking. People know about the health risks of smoking. There can't be a sane adult in the United Kingdom who isn't well aware of the health risks. And I would say that the overwhelming majority of teenagers are well aware of their health risks. So I've had two children that are now in their early 20s, but when they were teenagers, they got all the anti-smoking messages at school. As it happens, one then started to smoke, the other one didn't. And it's also, as I said, a lot of these messages actually, in some cases, have a sort of contrary effect on some people. But we did some research about 18 months ago using a group, Glasgow-based group called the Centre for Substance Use Research, Who've been used by the World Health Organization, by the Scottish Government. They've done work for the tobacco companies. And they did a survey for us of 600, what we call confirmed smokers. Now, a lot of these smokers were supporters of Forest, and they were confirmed smokers in the sense that basically they don't want to quit. And it was fascinating research, because one of the things we asked them is, why do you smoke? And of that 600 cohort, 95% they smoked because they got pleasure from smoking. And they said, we're so thankful that you've actually asked us. Nobody ever asks us why we smoke. People always assume that we're addicted to this, you know, this evil weed, and that we would give up if we wanted to. And by the way, I'm not denying that there are substantial numbers of smokers who do want to quit or cut down. Maybe wish they'd never started. But there, as I say, there's still millions of people who get a great deal of pleasure out of smoking. Now, again, this study was quite interesting because it found out that just over half said, yes, we probably are addicted, but actually we don't care if we're addicted because we get so much pleasure out of it. The pleasure outweighs that sort of that addiction. So I think one of our messages is that, look, if people want to switch, if they want to quit, that's all fine. But there are millions of people who enjoy smoking, and that must be respected. And I just want to say something about PMI. And this is not, I don't want to be seen to be having a go at Mark. I've known Mark for about 40 years, and I respect him for turning up and taking part in this debate today. But in terms of PMI, I think PMI have shown a huge amount of arrogance in the last 12, 18 months with some of their statements. I mean, putting $1 billion into an organization that's called Foundation for a Smoke-Free World, well, I think that's a real kick in the teeth for consumers, many of whom, as I say, enjoy smoking, get a great deal of pleasure from smoking. Some of the statements that have been made by sort of PMI executives are extraordinary. I mean, the CEO of PMI wants World No Tobacco Day renamed World No Smoking Day. And he suggested that we should promote every day as World No Smoking Day. Then you've got Mark's boss, Peter Nixon, who's the MD of Philip Morris in the UK. He stated in an interview with The Independent a couple of months ago, there is no reason for anyone to smoke anymore. Now, so I think that's a huge amount of arrogance, because the reason people are continuing to smoke is because they enjoy it. It's not because there may be better options for them. And again, who's to say what's better? That's very subjective. Yes, there might be sort of health benefits from switching, but if you get pleasure from smoking, then it's not a better product. And I think the companies actually, before they tell everybody to switch, they actually need to improve some of these products. Because again, what our report found out was that even amongst committed smokers, many of them, probably 30-40%, have tried e-cigarettes, but they don't get on with them, they don't like them. They have chosen to continue smoking. I do think PMI is almost like saying we want a smoke-free world. It's almost like PMI invented smoking. No, they didn't. People have been smoking since 5000 BC. The manufactured cigarette came along in the late 19th century. I've just finished reading a biography of Dickens. Dickens was a heavy smoker. That was long before the tobacco companies came along. So I think it's quite wrong for Philip Morris to say, well, you know, everybody should give up smoking and switch to our new product. I just think they need to moderate their language a bit, because I think they're turning off a lot of smokers at the moment.
Okay, well, that's very firm. Mark, I'll come back to you, but let me turn to Chris now. I mean, in some ways, Chris, I wanted you to try and untangle some of this, partly because you're associated with having really very much promoting vaping as an alternative to smoking. I don't mean that's the only thing, but you know, you are somebody who has done that. So maybe this is kind of a good thing, or do you think it's kind of like the wrong way for a company to go? And secondly, I suppose just there's always this kind of argument about the economy as well, which I know that you've had some thoughts on, just in terms of like what's good for the economy, bad for the company. Economy as a corporate kind of involves themselves in this.
Well, I don't know about that second point, but I mean, in the broadest economic sense of improving consumer well-being, which is really what economics is supposed to be about, the question of whether smoking should be consigned to history depends entirely on what people's preferences are. And so long as it's just one person who wants to smoke, possibly you, Claire, could be the last person standing, it should not be consigned to history. And whether it will be consigned to history, I think, is a more interesting question in a way. Simon just mentioned that people have been smoking for thousands of years. The death of smoking has been predicted several times in history and has never come about. If you know anything about alcohol prohibition, you may be familiar with the Anti-Saloon League. Less famous is the Anti-Cigarette League, which came along just after prohibition, actually, a classic example of the slippery slope. But their motto, their slogan was "A smoke-free America by 1925. Surgeon General Coop in 1986 had the slogan of "A smoke-free America by 2000 AD. This keeps getting pushed back and back and back. It's never really happened. Samuel Johnson in the 18th century, when snuff was becoming very, very popular, he said that smoking's nearly died out. What's gone on? Turned out that the English aristocracy were copying the French trend of using snuff, and that came abruptly to an end in 1789 when Robespierre started going around slaughtering the French aristocracy, and French customs suddenly became rather less popular. So it's been predicted many times. There's been times when it seemed plausible that it would happen. On the other hand, the cigarette itself, if we're just talking about cigarettes, I think it makes it a little bit more realistic. I mean, people, I think, will always smoke cigars from time to time, at the very least. The cigarette has only really been popular for just over a century. It is quite possible that with vaping and IQOS-type products and anything else that's in the works, smoking could be not consigned to history, but become a very small niche minority pursuit. The daily smoking rate in Sweden, where they use smokeless tobacco, is now 5%, and it's been dropping like a stone, and they may well go down to 1% or 2% quite conceivably in the next decade. It's conceivable smoking could go down to something like 5% in the next 20 years in Britain. It will not be consigned to history, however. It may well become on the verge of obsolescence as a result of the carrot of harm reduction and the stick of punitive anti-smoking regulation, but there will always be some people who choose to smoke cigarettes or pipes or cigars or whatever it may be. You can look out for, you know, other kind of examples. People talk about the Kodak moment with e-cigarettes. Well, there are still some people who use old-fashioned analog photographic equipment and film, and probably always will be. CDs have been around for 30 years, but vinyl is doing very well these days. More people buying vinyl than have done for a long time. You know, the motor car was supposed to get rid of horses, but, you know, clearly horses are not as popular a mode of transport as they once were, but people still ride horses. So this, you know, I think if you've got something that's been consumed very happily by many people for thousands of years, the idea that it's going to just disappear by any means is quite implausible. And there is a very good reason why the cigarette has been fantastically popular for 100 years. It's an extremely efficient and pleasurable nicotine delivery device. So I don't think it will be consigned to history in probably our lifetimes, but more importantly, I don't think it should be, so long as there's anybody in the world who wants to smoke.
Okay, thank you, Chris, that was really useful. Ray, if I just turn to you, and then I'll put a broad question to everyone after that, but I suppose the way Chris has approached it, which is interesting, is to just say, well, you know, there's fads, not fads, but, you know, they might well be that this was the particular nicotine delivery for 100 years. The odd person like me might carry on, but actually it might just be old-fashioned, right? It might just technology. And actually, Philip Morris is saying the same. It's kind of a technological step forward, which seems quite different to the tone of Simon sort of saying, come on, you know, you're hectoring us and all the rest of it. Just looking at the kind of tobacco industry, as you have done over the years, how do you locate what's going on at the moment?
I think there's a fair amount of confusion amongst investors and some of my peer group of analysts as to exactly what's going on, because so much of this is outside of areas of traditional distribution and product. Without doubt, there have been some areas where IQOS in particular has had exceptional success, and if you take a look at Japan, you've seen huge dislocation in the Japanese market. Now, the best part of 20% of the market has substituted conventional cigarettes for a heat-not-burn product. Philip Morris has been at the forefront of that. But what's been particularly interesting about it is that at the start of this year, it hit a massive air pocket in terms of growth. And what was clear was that Philip Morris's internal expectations for growth were totally wrong. They had straight-lined an expectation about how everyone would be converting to this lower risk product, and were wrong. The people that wanted to adopt early did. Subsequently, growth in the sector has been considerable. There's still been growth, don't get me wrong, but it's been considerably slower, and that forced the company into having a profit warning at the start of the year. And then subsequently a second one 3 months further down the line as well, because the follow through on demand just hadn't been there. In that respect, you know, there are areas of concern. Vaping was a concern when it first came to the market in 2011, was popularised, and different companies now stress different areas as what they believe will be the area to take forward. Philip Morris majors on IQOS and says that that is the answer and it is the product, but with respect to the mesh product, there actually hasn't been such a strong offering in vaping. Go and talk to Imperial Tobacco, or Imperial Brands as they'd rather be called. They major on vaping because they don't have a heat not burn product. So you've got two sides of companies inevitably doing what they do. Will smoking become history? Well, I've read somewhere that, coming back to this point about prevalence, everyone tends to look at the percentage of populations that smoking, tend to ignore the denominator effect. So I read somewhere that by 2025 there'll still be somewhere between 1 billion and 1.1 billion smokers, roughly the same as today. When I say I read that somewhere, that was on Philip Morris International Science website. So quite clearly, Philip Morris still believes there's going to be plenty of smokers out there. And having spent the last 2 days of last week at their annual investor event, quite clearly there's every intention to carry on servicing them, even if they'd much rather talk about IQOS much more than they would about that core cigarette business, which is the part which still makes all of the money and still has to pay the dividend and the salaries. And therefore, they won't be walking away from it anytime soon. In respect to some of the other bits and pieces, I am in print, as having said, I am particularly concerned about the approach that Philip Morris has used in trying to open a debate with regulators, with the health lobby, about this desire to move rapidly to a smoke-free future, because customers have been, for 40, 50 years, increasingly under the cosh of ever higher taxation, ever more vitriolic messages from public health about how stupid they are to carry on smoking. They have loyally bought the products of these companies, and now you've got the largest of them saying, well, actually, we kind of agree and we don't think you should smoke either. And I think that's wrong. I do think that's a very dangerous approach. And in my callow youth, having been an investor in Ratner's and feeling particularly proud of myself because I bought it after it had fallen 80%, only to find there's no limit to the number of times a stock can carry on halving on you. With a very old joke about prawn sandwiches, that disrespect shown to the customer, I think is absolutely awful in a fast-moving consumer goods industry. And that is a particular area I think people are still quite concerned about the approach publicly that Philip Morris is trying to take for corporate reasons, which I understand, but the messaging is too blunt.
Okay, so I'll obviously come back and see what you think about that. But I think the context as well for me is, I think there is a sense in which if you are a consumer of a product and the company that makes that product talks to you as though you're an idiot, that's not a great moment in life. I mean, you know, that it might only be a small percentage, but it's a percentage that chooses to do it. So that's one thing. But there's a broader question, which maybe, Chris, you can also address, which is the whole atmosphere around regulation and denormalising of something that the people choose to do, which has actually moved way away from tobacco now into alcohol, into sugar, into salt, I mean everything and anything, as you know. It feels to me as though there's a danger that you as a corporate in that messaging might actually end up becoming part of the kind of, I mean, I don't know why you think that IQOS will escape this, is what I'm trying to say. I mean, vaping certainly hasn't. It becomes still a tobacco substitute. Whereas if you deploy the same kind of hectoring language, as it were, and this is an evil, you know, almost like this is a really bad thing, that actually you'll end up shooting yourself in the foot, but it will be as usual used to actually just prohibit, which is one of the things that Chris has been so important at tracing how that's happened more broadly against consumer choices that are no longer, everything's like tobacco these days. But anyway, anything you want to pick up?
There's some interesting points. Look, you're right, you do have to get the balance right. And I also reflect on the experience of Juul in the, I don't know how many people are familiar with the experience in the States, where, you know, they're a Silicon Valley startup. They think they're saviors of the world. They don't make cigarettes. So almost they might look to us like the kind of company we might become in the future. And of course, they've been hugely successful with their e-cigarette in the States, but have then had exactly the same sort of treatment from the regulator there. In some ways, you know, some kind of first time that the regulators in the States have really taken a very, very harsh look at e-cigarettes, you know, potential threats to stop them selling certain products. So look, you clearly got to get the balance right. I don't think that we think that there is that IQOS, one of our products, is the complete solution. I guess I take the view. We have four platforms. We have two, one that's been launched, one that's just being launched, and we've got others in development. I don't even think if we had all of those, there will be a product that's right for everybody, but there will be other competitors that will come, all sorts of innovation. And one of the things, again, as a kind of newcomer to the industry, my observation is that for the first time, in the e-cigarette business at least, it is not dominated by the kind of big four cigarette companies. So what that means is there's more innovation in that sector than you've seen in cigarettes for decades. And that means that hopefully there will be more innovative products that, you know, in the end might provide an option for every smoker. And the very fact, just to come back to Juul again, the very fact that Juul is a kind of Silicon Valley startup, they clearly would never have started making cigarettes. So you've got a company with a lot of resources that is determined to be a big player in this sector. I regard that as a good thing because I think innovation in this sector is incredibly important. And look, the fact that we spent $3 billion is of interest, but most of the other cigarette companies have spent very little. So if you are to develop products that provide something that could be an option for every smoker, you are going to need a lot of companies spending a lot of money developing those different alternatives. I don't even know what they might be. They might be what we're producing. It may be that someone else comes along. But I do think that, to Simon's point, look, of course I recognise there's a balance in what we have to say, but you know, this is what we've described as what our company's vision is, what our company is doing. Other companies can make different choices, and I note with interest that none of the others have signed up to, at some point, going smoke-free. I think that's a mistake, to be frank, on their part, and I think they're suffering as a consequence. And I certainly don't accept the contention that in some ways what we've done has turned off our consumers. Obviously, I know what the sales of our products are. There's no sign of that happening. You're right, we have to get the balance right in our communications. But I think that what we have done has allowed us as a company to have conversations with regulators and other potential business partners that are closed off to other companies. Just to give you one example, we have a number of IQOS shops in London. When we started to try and have an IQOS shop, most property owners said no tobacco. And they would not have allowed us if we were selling cigarettes. I mean, it sounds incredible, but most big property owners who own most of the big shopping centres, Blue Water and the like, no tobacco. Sorry, we can't deal with you. And that affects every single part of our business, whether it's YouGov that say they won't do research for us, whether it's property owners, whether, you know, whoever it is, we find doors closed to us that are now opening. So it's not, of course, there's a benefit of us engaging with the government, and what we've done, I think, enables us to do that, but actually enables us to do all sorts of other things that are not possible for other cigarette companies.
Okay, so pragmatic, allows doors to be opened if you kind of move away from your core product and create something else?
Yeah, I mean, look, I'm not particularly upset or offended by anything Philip Morris has been saying about their product. I mean, they've got a product that they can't advertise or market in any way, and they want to make some noise around it. It's perfectly reasonable. You know, the Philip Morris is not going to be infringing on smokers' freedoms or stopping them doing anything. I'm much more concerned when governments set a target for abolishing smoking, because they are actually going to use the stick. And I think it's quite interesting if you look at the rhetoric around tobacco control now in various different governments, including the UK. Scotland has a target of being smoke-free by 2034. Not quite sure where that number comes from, but that is their target. Finland, I think, 2025, New Zealand, 2030. I'm not sure about the dates, but it's around that area. Various countries have decided they're going to be tobacco-free or smoke-free. And so has Britain. It hasn't got a specific date in mind, but the goal of policy now is to have a tobacco-free England. And I think that's interesting in the sense that up until very recently, the justification, or if you prefer, excuse, for anti-smoking legislation was around externalities or consumers being uninformed. So we need to have these warnings on because people don't know the risks. We need to have a smoking ban because the damage of secondhand smoke or the nuisance of secondhand smoke creates negative externalities. Plain packaging was kind of the very final thing where it's like, well, advertising is bad, we can't have any advertising, we're going to claim the packaging is the last bastion of advertising. And it really was the last bastion. There's literally nothing else they can think of to do now. But more importantly, there's no other real justification. Even if you swallow all the justifications for advertising bans and smoking bans and so on, there's nothing left. And so now it's just very blunt. And I think finally, actually honest, is we don't like smoking and we're going to wipe it out. We don't care whether people are just smoking in their own homes and not causing a nuisance to anybody, they have their own health insurance and all the rest of it. We don't like it and we're going to put a stop to it. That's really always been the agenda. And Mark is right that the government's not really planning on legislating in this parliament, but that's largely because they haven't got any policies left. The only thing the anti-smoking lobby are on about now is let's make sure the money keeps coming into smoking cessation services and groups like ourselves. Maybe have a tobacco levy, but actually that's not going to work, so we'll do shit. They're not really campaigning for anything. They've done the lot. But the plan, which has never gone out to any kind of consultation, they've never involved stakeholders like Claire asking them, do you think we should have a smoke-free society by 2035? No one's ever been asked about this, it's never been put in a manifesto, but apparently that's the policy. And so everything that happens between now and then is going towards this this target that no one's ever actually agreed to and doesn't, in fact, make any ethical sense.
I think that's the concern, by the way, about the smoke-free, which is that is the agenda that has not been democratically... I mean, it's one thing banning all the things that have happened to cigarettes, and so it's kind of weird then when that's being led by a tobacco company, because it feels more of a crusade than just a pragmatic... You explain it pragmatically and then say, but we want smoke-free, but that's where we'll end up. So it's more kind of a warning to you that whether you like it or not, that's the way you're going, right?
And tobacco-free, not just smoke-free.
Yeah, I mean, they won't stop there. I mean, that's the thing, is when Bristol City Council, who just said they want to be smoke-free earlier than anyone else, you know, the idea they're going to be saying, but bring your IQOS and your vape along, I mean, it's not got that tone to it, right? What they mean is, we will clean out and sanitise this city of that type of behaviour. And that type of behaviour is...
I think that's unfair. Look, there is a divide in the public health community. There are those who want to do exactly as you've just said. They just want anyone using any form of nicotine to be no longer able to use them. But there is a very significant part of the community that obviously we try to engage with, which doesn't take that view. Now, whether they take that view if there were no cigarettes ever left, I can't say. But for the moment, a very similar, ASH itself, you know, many of the sort of public health academics, they take the view, pragmatic view, that if you can help people to convert away from cigarettes to these alternatives, that's perfectly okay.
Let Chris ask a question. Now I'm going to turn over here anyway. But yeah, quick.
You don't recommend IQOS for anybody other than existing smokers,
nope.
Right?
Nope.
And you want to reach a point as soon as possible where there are no smokers. So what is the long-term prospects for PMI? Within sort of 70 years, there's no smokers to convert to IQOS, and all the IQOS smokers are getting older and dying. So within a century, the absolute outside, you're finished, aren't you?
Well, I guess we have quite a big challenge with those billion or 1.1 billion smokers. So if we could get 300, 400 million of those, to convert to IQOS, I think that's a big enough challenge for now. What you do in the longer term feels more like a debate for somebody else to have.
Join ASH. Right, so if the... No, but you know, it is hard to see. That. I think you've got a point, which is it's weird. But I think that one of the things that I wanted to say is, I think that Mark's making a really good case for saying, actually, this is just a straightforward, you know, most consumers could change. You know, it's not as though when you're born, you think I must smoke, if you know what I mean. So if you were born, so that answer was a bit weird, because I think you would then say, well, we've got this brilliant product called IQOS, right? You know, you never have heard of a cigarette, but if you as a company, you'd want people to take up the tobacco alternatives or the nicotine alternatives and so on and so forth. So that's kind of the thing. But Simon, in all seriousness, what's wrong with that? You know, moving aside from the fact that we don't like the hectoring tone, or that you don't, is there anything wrong with the aspiration for smoke-free?
Well, apart from the fact it would remove choice. But let me make it clear, I'm not trying to reverse society to the 50s and 60s when 80% of men were smoking, 40% of women were smoking. Society moves on. And, you know, lots of things change in society. I mean, I'm not against change at all, but I think this is quite relevant for a conservative audience, because my understanding of being a conservative is that you're not against change, but you like change to happen over a period, not overnight. And I think when you start setting targets, like say we want to be smoke-free by 2030, it's very unlikely that society will change enough on its own in the next 12 years to create a smoke-free society by 2030. If we had a smoke-free society which was entirely voluntary, I would have no problem with that at all. But I say, well, as soon as you set targets, which are very difficult to meet, that's when government steps in and we start getting all these rules and regulations designed to force people to quit. Now, one or two people on this panel have said, oh, well, the government, you know, hasn't got any plans for further legislation at the moment on cigarettes. Personally, I think that's rather complacent, because it's true they're not planning to introduce more legislation. But what's happening on the ground is that local councils are actually increasingly introducing outdoor smoking bans. They're making it that the net is tightening on smokers all the time. We're seeing smoking banned. First of all, they pick on children's play areas. I'm not suggesting people should wander into children's play area and spark up. I mean, that'd be ridiculous. But they're banning smoking in beaches, family-friendly festivals. Eventually, it will be parked anywhere where a child might conceivably be present. And they have to do that if they want to meet these type of targets. I mean, again, you know, when we hear about all this stuff about, you know, they won't attack vaping. Well, Public Health England, you know, are generally considered to be pretty liberal on vaping. But even Public Health England have made it very clear they only see vaping as a short-term activity. Basically, they want to get people off smoking using e-cigarettes, because it's been one of the most successful ways in the last few years of getting people off smoking. But nobody in Public Health England, or indeed the tobacco control lobby as a whole, see vaping as a long-term activity. They don't see it as something pleasurable, as something recreational. It's seen as a medicinal tool. It's seen alongside nicotine gum and nicotine patches. And as soon as you then start talking about, or maybe even putting it on prescription through the NHS, that is going to kill the product. Because the thing is, smokers don't regard themselves as sick. They want something that's pleasurable. And you've got to maintain the idea of vaping and e-cigarettes as a recreational tool that is something that people can enjoy. And I think Public Health England will destroy that, because they see it as a short-term thing.
Right, one of the things I was thinking about was, and in fact, it was mentioned at the beginning that this is kind of very much a Western discussion. And the majority, of course, of smokers and not, you know, and the growing consumers are not for the West. So is there a danger here for any company, which is it's kind of pandering to a kind of fashion in the West, and in a kind of being all ethical, but in fact, you know, for billions of people who were kind of, you know, they're happily flogging their wares, as it were. I mean, that seems to me to be at least a tension in this argument.
There are obviously huge tectonic plates in tobacco generally about where the population growth is and how people consume and what they do. So with the best will in the world, in many emerging markets, the biggest challenge is to try and get people away from buying single sticks to buying packets of 5 or 10. Now, if that's the limit of your expenditure, there's no way you're going to be hosing out $100 for an IQOS starter kit.
Yeah.
Not for very many years to come. Maybe that's our 30-year story rather than the 3-year story. Certainly developed markets, there are differences. In developed markets, so Japan's gone heat not burn, Western Europe's typically vaping. Heat not burn has not been anywhere near as impactful across Western Europe as it has been. In the US, it's maybe been a vaping market, but Juul has been interesting because quite clearly Juul's apparent success has definitely been amplified by certain of the anti-tobacco lobby to make it look bigger than it actually is, and to create this idea of an epidemic which is probably not fully supported by all of the genuinely available statistics. You're right, Silicon Valley boys, and they've done very well. They've hosed themselves out a very big capital raising at a huge implied valuation of $15 billion for a business which doesn't make a profit. And then the regulator came along just after they'd raised the money. I mean, it's classic pump and dump with the stock market, really. So there's quite a lot of different things moving in all of this. That point about that 1 to 1.1 billion smokers is the vast majority of them will be in emerging markets. They will have much lower average daily consumption. And frankly, the life expectancy decision is entirely different. Cigarettes are something they enjoy, and they will use them because they enjoy them. And it'll be a long time till they're in a position of wanting to go into a vaping or a heat-not-burn type of product instead.
But just
not
that,
least of which, because of the convenience.
I'll let you come in quickly, and then I want to go back.
Just on that point, look, it's about a direction of travel. Look, obviously, you're right that in many parts of the developing world, although the prevalence isn't rising, the number of smokers is rising because those countries that have fast-rising populations are taking up smoking. But the prevalence rate isn't rising. But in vast parts of the world, prevalence rates are falling. And Chris mentioned Sweden, and one wonders what would happen in the rest of Europe if snus, heat-not-burn, e-cigarettes were both available and could be marketed to smokers, because the biggest problem, it includes e-cigarettes, is that restrictions around making smokers aware that these products exist or that they are less harmful are so complete that there's no wonder why people don't switch. And to your point about Japan, so one of the ironies is that in Japan you can advertise cigarettes, but you can also advertise IQOS. So one of the, and presumably if e-cigarettes were available, you could do that too. So actually one of the ironies is the very reason why there's been a 25% fall in the number of cigarettes in Japan is because you can actually tell consumers, inform them about alternatives. If that were the case in Europe, I wonder what the number of smokers would be. I'm not saying that it will be zero, but you can certainly think, hang on, if all of these products are available and consumers were informed about them, perhaps partly by government, but mostly by the manufacturers, because they're the best people to actually provide that information, maybe the smoking rates in those countries would be much lower and the take-up of these alternatives would be significantly higher.
Okay, so lots to discuss. I think some of the really interesting and broader points, by the way, beyond smoking are, for example, what do you do if you have an increasing number of companies that are producing products that society tuts at? You know, this could be as likely, it's not just tobacco, I mean, the gambling industry, if you create, you know, sugary products, you know, make chocolate and suddenly become, you know, in the frame. Do you kind of go down, alcohol, do you kind of go down the rebranding route or the kind of, actually we're doing something different? Or, you know, I mean, it's, as you said, you get audiences that you wouldn't get, and especially because tobacco is always the one where everyone goes, oh God, can you imagine what it's like to be tobacco? Because nobody will talk to them. I mean, at least people are talking to Philip Morris. But that's an interesting one, right? How you kind of deal with that? Just in terms of as conservative audiences, people have said, you know, I'm not a conservative, I'm more in the kind of lefty libertarian camp. But what's the kind of balance there between kind of being excited about these new technological changes and consumer choice? I mean, is it just me being old-fashioned and not seeing the virtues of future choices by clinging on to old choices? And maybe that's not a kind of model for moving forward. But anyway, anyone want to say anything? I'm going to take 3 or 4 points. You don't have to ask questions. Points, public conversation, then see what the audience thinks. What the panel thinks. Yes,
thank you. Nick White from Dover in Somerset. I had a little mini exchange with Simon in advance, saying I was disappointed that we haven't got the cosy chat of an MP up there saying that actually we will fight, as a writing libertarian, for the consenting adults to have a room in a pub or a club where they could actually enjoy products. So I think we're ever giving ground on that, and we've become the new no blacks, no dogs, no Irish of society. So as a matter of principle, when my hotel that I checked into says you will be fined £150 if you smoke in the room, I got a little cross by it, because being a lawyer, I would argue that's bollocks. So we will then put a towel by the door and open the crack in the window as far as the safety people will allow and have a cigarette. And when the room says it's been specially prepared for non-smoking, any special preparations, they remove the ashtray. So that's my rant. Diversity and inclusion should include smokers. We have a lot of dictation from the government. And I was very jumped when I went into the conference hall exhibition area yesterday. The first thing I came across was your stand, Mark. And I had a Monty Python five-minute argument with your dad, who said, smoke-free doesn't actually mean smoke-free, it means 5%. So when I've finished, please come back on that. I don't think it's your job to dictate and condescend in the same way as government does. It's to inform and to educate. So you've been in for a bit of a kicking today. I hope I've added to it a bit, because I think you're missing the point. And the other point that you might think about smoke-free products is the default position of railway companies, airlines, conference centres, is no smoking, bracket, including e-cigarettes. Mm. So whichever way you turn, you're a bit of a turkey voting for Christmas. Just adding to that, when you reply, could you add a bit of comment about how you fared post-plain packaging? Because I'd be interested to know whether there's any brand recognition or swapping over or whatever. So I've gone on a bit. But
no, very interesting. Thank you. Thank you. The gentleman there and then behind. Yeah,
Andrew Allison, Freedom Association. So you probably see where I'm coming from in all of this. You know, I gave up smoking when my wife was pregnant. I said I wanted to give up smoking before he was born. And I did, 2 weeks before he was born in 2016, just before the EU referendum. And believe me, that was a very stressful time to completely give up smoking. But I've gone on to e-cigarettes. And as Simon knows, I do the Freedom to Vape campaign for the Freedom Association, things like that. But I've got to agree with Simon. This is essentially about freedom to choose, freedom of choice. Now, I think it's absolutely wonderful there are lots of new products on the market. I'm really pleased that I gave up smoking, and I thoroughly, just like Chris and Martin here, we thoroughly enjoy e-cigarettes. And I get a lot of pleasure from vaping. But I used to get a heck of a lot of pleasure from smoking as well. I've just substituted. And it really does worry me that the Public Health England, the SDS, they will support vaping now, they'll support IQOS, they think it's all wonderful, it's all absolutely great. Then they'll get down to this sort of smoke-free, which isn't smoke-free future, of 5%, and then they'll start going for these products again. I mean, Chris and I were having a discussion just a couple of hours ago. We've got a little bit of an obsession, both of us, we didn't realise this, for looking for obese children. Because we don't believe that there are that many obese children.
No one is to tweet that.
Well, they can do. They can do if they want to. So what I did is I walked in a local sort of retail park into an Asda supermarket and back again. In 15 minutes, I counted 130 children, and about four or five of them looked overweight, maybe about two obese and all the rest of it. But the government just tells us that we got loads and loads and loads of obese children, and action must be taken. The reason I sort of go off in that little direction is that this is what they do. They're going to find something else all the time. They're going to take away the freedom of choice from smokers, and you know, all of us at a party conference will have a few drinks at some point or other, and no doubt plenty of other people will be paying for those drinks. They're going to go for that. They're going for sugar already. They're going for obesity. There's everything, and there is a fundamental issue, and it's freedom of choice. And I think too many people have just conceded that smoking is bad for you, therefore, yeah, it's fine. Let's take away their freedom of choice. But it's that old argument, isn't it? You know, they came for the smokers, but I wasn't a smoker, etc. And I think that's the fundamental issue in all of this.
Okay, thank you. The gentleman behind you. Yeah. Can you pass the... Yeah.
Thanks, Claire. A comment and a question. A comment, some of us were discussing before lunch, smoke-free zones, etc. My experience from being father of then young girls when Ireland introduced the ban was harumph on freedom grounds, followed by, oh, I'm going to have to get wet outside, followed by, actually, I can now take my kids for lunches in pubs.
I've got a bad
actually, on balance, I think that's a good thing. You're on holiday. What we're looking for is a balance, however. And I think it was you, Claire, said that in parts of continental Europe, they have a stricter licensing regime where people know what they're getting. There is a choice. It's a hoop to go through, but you can have a smoking bar. And you have non-smoking, the majority non-smoking, so you don't get, you know, market forces and externalities, but you deal with the nuisance effect. People know what they're going for. Why the hell can't we do that in this country? That's a comment and question. My second question is, and this is a sort of evidence-based panel, one of the arguments the regulators use against vaping and smoke substitutes is that they're a gateway product and that young teenagers, etc., will be caught in. What is the evidence? Because you've got a control group in Japan where you're able to advertise alternatives as well as smoking, and Western Europe where you'd say, well, this isn't a gateway product because nobody knows it exists as teenagers and it's only one way, it's a gateway but only one way. What's the evidence?
Okay, good. Anything else? I thought I saw one other hand. I'll take you, sir. Yes, is that hand you? Yeah. Both of you, and then I'll come back to the panel, then I'll go back one more.
I wonder what the economic arguments are either case for the country, for the economy in general. I presume the government is so keen on banning smoking because then people use the NHS less, they get sick less. So that's my assumption. But I guess the panel will have a lot of data to show otherwise. Maybe the tobacco industry is good for the economy in some way or employs a lot of people. So I'm just curious about the economic take on it, because I don't like that expression, but the common sense sort of argument, which most people assume, is that, I mean, it's good for the country and for the economy if people smoke less or consume less sugary products, alcohol, and so forth. And then that's probably one of the reasons that it's being pushed so hard. But, looking forward to hearing your thoughts.
Okay, thank you. And the person next to you, then. Yeah.
So, Mark, you referenced snus, and Sweden came up a couple of times in the discussion. Snus, it gets a lot of bad press. You know, it's banned in Iceland. It's very hard to get outside of Scandinavia. Should more of the discussion be on trying to win the argument about snus? Because that is a product which doesn't need to be developed. It exists there now. Should we not be trying to get that, you know, to UK consumers so that they have that option? And would that not help achieve both our desire for freedom and also public health outcomes, which perhaps others on the other side of the debate are trying to achieve? Thank you.
Okay, thanks. So, I mean, I think for the panel, pick up anything you want. I think that one of the questions has to be, would there be anything wrong with just having cigarettes and IQOS and vaping, you know, all there, you just take your pick, kind of as unregulated as possible, but just where you'd have the choice, right? And snus, whatever, right? So you just go, what would appeal to me? But that would seem to be a way forward rather than the smoke-free outcome, which seems a bit kind of saying you want to end up here. But the other thing is that people keep saying the public health. I mean, one of the things I'd say to you as a conservative audience is public health as a value has become an end point, as though that is kind of the value. And there is a kind of weird situation because you can choose to live a free life doing things that are unhealthy, but you wouldn't think so. I mean, that is allowed. I mean, you know, if you're a sports person, and we know if you go mountain climbing, these things are, you know, you take risks, right? Is that gone? Because whenever I have, you know, I'm always surprised at how many conservatives now just accept that public health as an end value is the way society should live. And is that good? I mean, you know, I don't necessarily think it is, but I want to know, because people just say it as though, of course, that's what we'd want. Anyway, anyone want to start? Why don't I start with you? Yeah.
So I take that. On that economics of smoking, that, Chris, you can correct me if I get any of these numbers wrong. Roughly, if you take the UK, duty and VAT comes in at about 11 billion sterling a year. The government estimates it loses about 2 billion of income to non-UK duty paid product. So that's people bringing stuff back legally or increasingly, and this is a major issue for the industry, illegally bringing things in. And it's much easier, obviously, with plain packaging than it used to be. Because, again, we always talk about counterfeit cigarettes. The cigarette is the last thing you counterfeit. You counterfeit a box, because all people see is the box and it's wrapped in plastic. So you don't try them before you buy them, do you? So there's another 2 billion lost. And the NHS last estimate got up to about 2.7 billion, I think.
3.5 is the most, I think, they claim.
Yeah, but we're way off in terms of the value that smokers provide. Some of the more interesting things when you look at longevity, however, of the smoking-related deaths in the UK on last year's mortality data, 25% of all of the deaths were people over 85. And
60% were over 75, and 84% from memory were over 65, so give or take retirement age. So generally, even on the data of smoking kills, it kills you quite late. Everyone's got an anecdote. My one is that my grandmother smoked her first cigarette at the age of 6 and was chased around Tooting Broadway by the policeman, because in those days Tooting Broadway only had the one, and she died a week short of her 89th birthday. People had to light her cigarettes for her by the end, but that wasn't bad going. My own father barely drank after his 21st birthday when he got married. I think the two are related. Never smoked and died at 70 of stomach cancer. So that comes under the category of it happens. Theoretically, if people didn't smoke, then the people who say it takes 10 years off your life, then you live 10 years longer, and as Chris has done with plenty of work, those health costs ramp up at the end. So we will have gone without the income from smoking, and we'll get all of the healthcare costs of people living longer. Doesn't sound so good. On Gateway, someone asked about absolutely no evidence that people... Kids try stuff. They might try vaping, they might try smoking. They might carry on. Do people start by vaping and then move on to smoking cigarettes? Nah, no real evidence of that at all.
Okay, Chris.
I think Ray's explained the economics of it very well there. When the NHS was created in 1948, about 60% of the population smoked, roughly speaking, and the healthcare expenditure for the NHS was 0.5% of GDP. We now have a smoking rate of 16%. And healthcare expenditure is 9% of a much larger GDP. You are not going to save any money by preventing smoking, or indeed obesity, actually. It's just one of the many excuses people use for interfering in other people's lives, which, as I said before, is now seems to be coming to an end in favour of just a position of, we don't like it, we're going to go smoke-free. It's interesting, isn't it, how the word smoke-free has changed definition over time as well. I mean, in 2007, England went smoke-free, and that meant no smoking in so-called public places. Now smoke-free means no smoking. There will be no smokers. And that is almost interchangeable with tobacco-free. You know, World No Tobacco Day, campaign for tobacco-free kids. There's no doubt in my mind that if it hasn't happened already, the war on smoking will be a war on nicotine. And I think e-cigarettes and heat-not-burn, similar products, are only tolerated as a short-term fix for what the anti-smoking lobby believe is the final generation of smokers. But as I said in my opening remarks, people have been predicting the final generation of smokers for a very long time. It hasn't happened. And this kind of war of attrition that we're seeing against smokers, which has only been paused, I think, briefly, because the smoking rate has been falling so rapidly in recent years. But if that rate of decline slows down, or heaven forbid, even starts to rise again, we will see a lot more anti-tobacco legislation, starting with things like outdoor smoking bans, smoking in people's own houses. Smokers, just a final point, smokers are treated really, really badly in this country. I was at the George Freeman's big festival, what is it called, Big Tent Festival, recently. This is outdoors, as you would imagine, various tents where people go and talk about politics in quite a large field. And yet you weren't allowed to smoke in the field. There was a tiny little pen right at the far end of the field, about 4 metres by 4 metres, where smokers had to stand in the outdoors on a fairly windy day. But that was the little pen, the little enclosure. It's more like deliberate humiliation now than it is anything else. I think in this country in particular, smokers are treated in an absolutely appalling way, and nobody seems to care about it.
By the way, I was speaking at that event, couldn't find the pen, eventually found the pen, having gone outside on a road where I was told off by a steward, so I had to go back into an open field to find the pen. Went to the pen, we saw somebody in the pen, and some people walked past and tut-tutted. I was in a pen, I was penned off, anyway, and did that, you know that terrible thing where people do this thing? We were in a field, talking about freedom. Oh, Simon.
Well, I think all the panellists have answered, you know, most of the questions. I wanted to come back to a gentleman. He mentioned the horrific phrase kids in pubs, which I would ban immediately. But no, he's absolutely right that after the smoking ban, a lot of people adapted to the ban, they were prepared to go outside. But I have to say, of all the different issues that have happened over the last 10, 12 years, we've had display ban, plain packaging, ban on tobacco vending machines, punitive taxation. The one thing that our core support still bang on about, 11 years after it was introduced in England, is the smoking ban, because that's the thing that, particularly for older people who'd been going into pubs for 50, 60 years, happily having a drink and a smoke, that's the thing that's actually had the most impact on their lifestyle. And it still seems crazy to me that we don't allow private landlords to choose their smoking policy. So if you had a family-friendly pub, fine, ban smoking. I mean, it's up to the publican. And the great sadness, again, as we're at a Conservative conference, is that not enough Conservative members of Parliament were prepared to stand up and support the free market and support the rights of private landlords to have their own policies, even if that meant separating smokers by having a separate smoking room. So, you know, the Conservatives haven't really covered themselves in glory over the last 10 years. A classic example being the display ban, which the Conservatives actually opposed when they were in opposition. As soon as Cameron got in with the coalition government, they were happy to push through Labour legislation, which was the display ban. Of course, plain packaging as well was pushed through under the coalition government. A lot of people think plain packaging came as a result of the EU. It had nothing to do with the EU. It was a classic example of the Department of Health in this country gold-plating EU policy, or at least going further than EU policy actually demanded. And of course, the smoking ban, as other people have mentioned, countries like Germany are much more liberal when it comes to smoking in public places, partly, I suspect, because of Germany's history. They're a bit reluctant to get too oppressive in terms of personal regulations and legislation and all the rest of it. But if you go around Germany, you can find lots of bars, particularly in cities such as Berlin, where you can smoke. Equally, there are non-smoking bars and restaurants. So what you end up with is choice. And this is what, again, comes back to what we talked about at the very beginning. It's all about choice. Somebody else mentioned about snus.
Last thing on snus.
Again, I mean, I'd love sort of snus to be legalised. There's absolutely no justification whatsoever for snus to be banned. I do happen to think, though, that we're not Scandinavia, we're not Sweden. I think there would be a cultural resistance to snus. But that's absolutely no reason to ban it. Let's get it out there, let's inform people about the health risks, and let consumers make their own choices.
Okay, well,
thank you. Yeah, so look, there were a number of questions that were raised that I think others haven't quite covered. Look, on snus, I do think it is pretty extraordinary. And what I found astonishing, considering that Public Health England takes the position that there are less harmful alternatives, is that the UK government opposed snus in a European court being allowed to be sold outside Sweden. So that struck me as a slightly odd position. Your point about smoke-free, so I think there's often confusion about that. The government has a target for smoke-free, which is 5% of the population. And indeed, there are some parts of the country already at that level. That would equate to about 2 million smokers. Obviously, smoke-free to everybody else means no smokers. So that may be where that confusion came. So you asked about, you know, our ambition for a smoke-free. Well, I see my job as running our company and to make our company smoke-free. Other companies are going to make different choices. And in terms of what that actually means, it means educating smokers, allowing them to make a choice for themselves, but based on them actually having information. So one of the things, for example, which of course is currently illegal, is we'd like to be able to put inserts directly into our cigarette packs with information about alternatives, whether it's e-cigarettes or heat not burned. And we're not allowed to do that. It feels to me like a kind of sensible step that we should be allowed to do. And your point about, which again is part of the kind of mixing e-cigarettes, heat not burn, and cigarettes together, it is true that lots and lots, whether it's planes or airlines or whoever it is, businesses, it's just you cannot use any of these nicotine products anywhere, and they do not make the difference. And I do think that part of our job, and certainly in terms of the engagement we do, we encourage them to differentiate. If you want to ban smoking in your for employees or create an area, whatever, that's up to you, but you must ensure that choice is not the same for less harmful products. And I've often thought it's a very peculiar thing that vapors the only place they can generally go and use their product, particularly if they've given up smoking, is to stand next to smokers. What could actually be more likely to encourage them to go back to cigarettes? And so I think that it feels very strange. And your question just briefly on plain pack, I don't think there's much evidence because actually lots of other changes came in at the same time on plain packaging, but the evidence we've seen so far is it's had no impact whatsoever in terms of people making different choices about the brands that they chose. In the longer term, you can see that it would have an impact on premium brands, because basically if all the packs look the same, why don't you just simply go for the lowest priced product, assuming it's a kind of flavour that you like. But to date, no evidence whatsoever that plain packaging has had any impact.
Claire will probably bark at me, just a supplementary on that. That plain packaging has no tar, nicotine, etc. information on it. Whereas, say I'm a heavy drinker and I know that gin is 40% and wine's 13%, beer's 5%, and I wanted to come down the scale. Why is it? It's probably not your company, it's probably legislation.
Yeah, it is, yes,
why
legislation.
Is it there is no information that would enable me to go light.
Okay, right, so answer that in a minute. Right, I've got time for a couple more questions if anyone wants. At the back there, yes.
Okay, so I'm actually a GP, and part of my area is one of the private areas of Derbyshire, and half the population still smoke, and most of them are probably going to die. So I'm a big fan of vaping, I push it all the time. But you go back over history, you know, nicotine use is probably not going to go away, but certainly the ways that we've used nicotine have changed substantially. If you go back 150 years, then the main way of using it was chewing tobacco. When was the last time you saw anybody using chewing tobacco? Or snuff? Or a pipe even? Amongst British doctors, we were once upon a time the world's heaviest smokers, British doctors. Heaviest smoking nation, and it went with social class. Stressful jobs, plenty of money. We smoked more than anybody else. So we were the group that were followed up by a guy by the name of Richard Doll from the 1950s. And within a couple of years, he showed the link with lung cancer, the link with heart disease. And within a decade or so, the percentage of doctors who smoked had halved. And these days, it's essentially zero. I don't know anybody in my area that smokes. Last smoker was a doctor in my practice, but he retired last century having had a stroke aged 62. So the prospect is that smoking, when it's still killing 80,000 people a year and kills every other person who does it, who uses it properly, has got to go. And it's going to go to some of these other products.
Okay, thanks. Heartfelt, GP. Yes, right, final thoughts, and I'll just grab a final thought from the panel. Yes.
Yes, hello. I've been involved in combating plain packaging in Europe and around the world. I just draw your attention to what's going on in Canada, which is on the verge of introducing plain packaging, yet they are allowing colourful packs, branding on cannabis packs. So here we have cannabis being actually marketed, and tobacco being not just the design but also the shape of the packaging severely restricted. So there's a major contradiction there.
It has to be said that I had a fascinating, just we work, the Academy of Ideas works with a lot of schools and 16 to 18 year olds, and I do a lot of talks in universities, and one of the more amusing things recently was being absolutely lectured about how stupid I was for smoking by students who then asked me if I'd like to, you know, who don't smoke because they're really smart, who then effectively asked me to partake of illegal substances that might not have been so good for them, but with no irony whatsoever did it have. And I said, oh, maybe it's not so good for you. And they said, we're young, we're taking risks. And I was thinking, so they're kind of like risk averse on smoking, but luckily not risk averse on everything, because otherwise they wouldn't be young. But I think rebellion takes a funny form, doesn't it? That's all I'm saying. Anything anyone finally wants to say from the panel? I'll just run along and you can just kind of say something. And I think that the GP's contribution at the back, of course, is hugely important, because ultimately I know myself, despite my comments of today, that if there are people I know who start smoking, I would rather they didn't. Right, so it's not as though I'm kind of like an enthusiastic zealot. However, on the other hand, I don't know that I need Philip Morris to educate me. That's more the point. I think I've worked it out that this is a stupid thing for me to do, but God knows I do stupid things. That's really my question to you. What is the balance in a free society with adults making choices about whether the end game should be smoke-free? Maybe should see whether people want it to be. But anyway, anything you want to pick up on?
Just briefly, I mean, the GP, I thought, made the right point. You know, if I told you there's a behaviour that would lead to the death of circa 80,000 people a year and 6 million smokers worldwide a year, you'd think, surely we can find something better as a way of stopping that happening. And the truth is that I regard my job as ensuring that smokers have the facts. It's true that they know that smoking is harmful, but what they don't always know is whether alternatives provide a better choice. And so I guess that's what I see our role in helping provide.
Okay, Chris.
I don't know what to conclude with, really. I mean, the GP at the back, it may well be right. You know, it may well be that this and IQOS and snus and goodness knows what else leads to cigarettes becoming effectively obsolescent and used by hardly anybody within a decade or two. Who knows? But it will, or it should, come down to people's choices. And you can go all over the statistics about the harms of smoking as many times as you want, but it ultimately comes down to a risk-benefit trade-off for individual consumers. I think everybody is certainly well-informed, over-informed possibly, about the risk of smoking. Vaping has done what a lot of draconian legislation failed to do, which is to actually bring down the smoking rate very significantly. It's fallen by 25% nearly since 2012. It didn't fall at all in the previous 5 years following the smoking ban, contrary to most people's expectations. It seems to me that the reason it's fallen so much since 2012 is because e-cigarettes have become a mainstream product in a way that they haven't anywhere else in the world, in fact. So, you know, I'm a vapor. I switched myself 6-7 years ago. I don't need convincing that lots of people can switch from cigarettes to e-cigarettes. My concern, however, is that when you have a group of people who are a minority, smokers, as they become a smaller and smaller minority, they become more and more vulnerable to being kicked and shoved around by busybodies and politicians. And I think, you know, in the spirit of John Stuart Mill, we should be most concerned about the minority in society, because the majority can always take care of itself.
Okay, thanks.
I echo many of those comments. I guess the point is that we all choose, or we should all be free to choose, what risks we want to take. I'm meant to be this paragon of virtue because I cycle to work, but I commute through London traffic. I mean, my life expectancy would probably be better if I smoked 40 a day. And so in that respect, consenting adults get to make their own choices. That has to be the case. Yes, give them as much information as they want, but I don't think people are as short of information as you might otherwise suggest. So should smoking be consigned to history? Only if people don't want to stop smoking.
Okay, thank you. Simon?
Well, I agree with that. The title of this event was Should Smoking Be Consigned to History? And if society decides it no longer wants to smoke, that's absolutely fine. But if it's a question of governments restricting people's freedoms to smoke, if it's about tobacco companies telling people, oh, we've set a target by which we're going to stop selling cigarettes and you should stop smoking because we want to have a smoke-free world, I think that's completely wrong. Because ultimately, ladies and gentlemen, it's all about choice.
OK, can we thank our panel, please? So, I do think that Simon's to be congratulated for organising this, because I think it was really interesting discussion and went beyond the usual just kind of nanny state and kind of moaning, and it was actually very useful to kind of consider all the options. And I think a particular credit to Mark and Philip Morris for actually participating as well, because if you're going to take this bold move, then I think you have to be accountable for it. And I think he was, and kind of really explained the case very well in terms of what the kind of strategy is, even if I personally don't agree with it. But I have taken on board what he's... Well, I mean, he's worked that out. they didn't ask me to be a neutral chair. Right, but we are actually taking Mark's advice, because the next event... which would be here in 45 minutes after you've had a beer, a cigarette, coffee full of sugar or whatever it is you're going to have, is the most pleasurable nicotine delivery device in the world, in which people are going to talk about the different nicotine products. Unfortunately, IQOS isn't there, though, but I'm sure it will be next year, as it were. And if you want to give out freebies to everyone, that I'm sure everyone would be delighted to try it out, as an aside. I think that just generally, not sort of saying the same old arguments over and over again, if you're pro-choice or pro-freedom, means that we all have to kind of show a little bit of humility and realise the world is changing and think about it without necessarily giving in to the new arguments as well. But I thought that was actually intellectually stimulating, so thank you very much, everybody. So thanks, panel.
That was good.